So what I'm going to try to cover basically is five parts here. I'm going to talk about something that we call the head direction signal. And first we'll tell you a little bit about the nature of it. And I'll show you a little video that demonstrates it very nicely. Then I'm going to talk about some sensory properties of these cells. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain and its circuitry, how the signal gets generated, in particular what areas of the brain seem to be important. Then I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about navigation, how these cells are used a little bit during navigation. And then, time permitting, at the end I'll talk a little bit about how these cells respond in three dimensions. Why doesn't that work? Okay. Now I can't go back. Yeah, I guess I can. Okay, it's going. It's going the reverse of what it usually does. Anyways, let me begin. I'll sort of pose a question. Do you know where the? Can you point to where the ocean is? Sitting. I mean, you've been here long enough. That way. Yeah. Okay. You think it's that way?
I mean, you can point
in
any direction.
That's true. I guess you're sort of sticking out here. Well, I mean, you might ask, how do you know it's this direction? You obviously can't see it while you're in this room. What?
I just mentally reconstruct how I have to move.
You mentally reconstruct. So what does that mean?
To exit the building, to turn around.
Yeah. So you do sort of like a little mental rotation. Yeah. All right, well, you might ask what areas of the brain are important for being able to do that. And as many of you know, a lot of people have sort of thought that this structure right here, the hippocampus, is very important for constructing a spatial map of your environment. And there's a number of reasons why people have thought that the hippocampus is very important for sort of your spatial orientation as well as navigation. I've listed just sort of three basic categories demonstrating that. One is there have been a lot of behavioral studies with animals, in particular the Morris water task. So are all of you familiar with the Morris water task? Anyone not?
You should. I would just do it. And also because it's not bad to reevaluate these things. I mean, a couple of mice swim a little bit better than other mice,
okay.
All of a sudden they're smarter, which is not the case for jocks swimming the pool.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, the Morris water maze task is a sort of a big tank of water, and you put the rats in, and the rat has to basically swim around to find a platform that's usually hidden beneath the surface of the water. So it's submerged about an inch or so beneath the water. And the rat basically has to learn where the platform is in the pool relative to the spatial cues that surround the pool. And rats are very good at this. You give them four or five trials, they will quickly learn where the platform is, and you put the rat down from any novel position within the perimeter of the pool, and they will immediately, in a pretty much straight line, in just 3 or 4 seconds, swim directly to the platform. Rats that have hippocampal lesions are impaired. They can't do it, okay? Particularly from novel locations. If you always start the rat from the same place, they can usually do it. But if you give them novel start points, they can't,
so,
they have difficulty.
So you're making a strong point. You're saying they have kind of an integrator that can take them to the right spot, but they can't perform what Misha did, a mental rotation.
No, they can do that because, I mean, this is a regular environment where there are plenty of landmarks. So they can sort of they could just triangulate where this platform is relative to where all the landmarks are within the environment.
But that's what's lost, the triangulation of the hippocampal region.
Well, I mean, now you're getting a little bit of another question. What is the function of the hippocampus? What algorithm is the hippocampus performing? And that, I think, has been sort of greatly debated. So, I mean, it could be a triangulation. It could be just, it could even be landmark recognition or being able to use the landmarks in some fashion. But in any case, certainly the hippocampus seems critical for performing that task. I think that is, everyone at least agrees with that. The second item I have on the list here is fMRI and PET studies with human. And there's been several studies doing that. The one I will illustrate here was done by McGuire in London. And basically, they sort of an interesting study. They took taxi cab drivers in London. And I don't know how many of you have been to London, but London is sort of pretty much like a maze of streets. And there's not a lot of, you know, big high-rise buildings to do landmarks by. But in any case, they asked the taxi drivers to, okay, starting at, you know, Piccadilly Circus, get yourself over to, you know, the Big Ben Tower or whatever. And the taxi drivers had to basically mentally sort of imagine a map and describe the map as they were being imaged by the scanners. And as you can see here, this area, which is the right hippocampus, lit up as they were doing it. Okay.
What was the control? I mean, did you see areas of primary visual cortex also light up?
I think the controls, let's see, for this study, it may have just been asking people, well, actually, I forget. I'd have to go back to the paper to see what the controls were. But I mean, they ruled out, you know, visual and, you know, and language types of things. You know, I mean, so that the controls were doing, you know, language types of tasks and visual tasks as well. Okay. Oops. So with the fMRI and PET studies with humans, you basically got activation of the right hippocampus when the taxi drivers were recalling routes. And then finally, and probably the most compelling, I think, is physiological recordings from single neurons in the hippocampus of freely moving animals. And these cells have been called place cells because they discharge when the animal's in a particular location within the environment. So for instance, if you looked at one cell within the hippocampus, one cell might fire right where I'm standing right now. And if I walked away from here, the cell shuts off. And if I walk back to the spot, the cell fires. And if you look at a second neuron nearby, it might do the same thing, but it would be a different spot, maybe the spot over there in the corner. And a third cell would do, again, the same thing, but have a different location. And if you took the sort of the sum total of all the cells that you recorded from, they pretty much, the cells were mapping out the entire environment that the rat happen to be in. Well, interestingly, that's a good question. Place cells have been, this is not, yeah. Place cells have been tried to be recorded from primates without a lot of success. There was one study by a Japanese group, Ono, where a monkey had to sort of drive a cart around within a small room. And they claimed that they got some cells that fired based on spatial selectivity, you know, location-specific firing. Edmund Rolls at Oxford has also done this with monkeys and has been unable to find so-called place cells. So it's, I mean, certainly in rats, it's probably the most prominent correlate you would see if you're recording from hippocampus in a freely moving animal. But primates, question mark.
Is it going to play a role in your talk?
Place cells, not too much. I'll come back to them a little bit, a couple of times.
Okay. I guess the question is, are they responding to places because that's the only, you're only correlating their spiking against where the animal is in the maze, as opposed to other aspects? I mean, there's sort of this eigenvalue view that depending on whatever the task is, there.
That's right. Certainly, yeah. I mean, I don't take the view that place cells are only encoding place. You can get a place cell. I mean, Howard Eichenbaum showed this very nicely over 10 years ago, where you can get a place cell very nicely, then put the animal through another task in a pretty much the same environment. And the task might be, in his case, it was a odor discrimination task where the animal had to sniff between two ports. And each port had two different odors. The animal learned that one odor was the correct odor, and when the animal sniffed that odor, it was supposed to go make a nose poke over in that one port as opposed to the other port. And if it did that, it got a reward. And when you recorded that same place cell in that type of task, you would see that the cells firing no longer fired based on the animal's location, but based, it was fired based on some, usually some temporal aspect of the task. Like it might be locked to the animal sort of sniffing the two odors, or it might be locked to when the animal made the response to go over to one of the two ports. So hippocampal cells are certainly very flexible, which is going to be very different from what I'm going to show you here in a second. Okay? Now, so you have place cells in the hippocampus. And if you start thinking about spatial orientation, which I really would sort of like you to think more along those lines rather than just location, but just sort of think in terms of general spatial orientation, there's really two major sort of fundamental components to it. One is certainly location, and the other is your directional heading. I mean, it doesn't do you any good to just know where you are if you don't know what direction you are within the environment. So in order to really know your spatial orientation, you have to have a second component that describes or encodes your directional orientation within that environment. Okay? And place cells do not provide that type of information. If a place cell, generally if the animal is in an open field, if this is the place where the cell likes to fire, you would see that it fires if the animal walks through the place field this way, or if the animal walks through it this way, or you know this way. So it doesn't matter how the animal happens to be oriented within that place, the cell will fire. So place cells do not provide very much.
In a sense, they do provide information if you just integrate over time. Like if you, at a given moment, they don't tell you, you say where the rat is or the animal is directing. But if you just wait for the next moment and integrate, if you know where you are now, where you are in the next moment, you can figure out where you are.
That's true. Yeah. But, yeah, but it would, okay. I mean, it's certainly not encoded within one cell because the place cell, I mean, you would need the network properties to, I mean, you'd have to see where you were, just came from and where you're going in the future, and then you could draw a vector, you're right. In order to encode directional heading, you have a second sort of category of spatial cells, which encodes just that, your directional heading. And these cells have been called head direction cells. And essentially, head direction cells fire whenever the animal points its head in a particular direction, independent of where it happens to be located. So, I mean, one head direction cell will fire as my head's facing this way. I turn my head away, the cell will shut off. Turn my head back here, the cell will fire. And I could, you know, I could be over here and the same thing will happen. And again, as long as my head is facing this way. And it's head direction, not body direction, so that the body is this way and the cell's off now and I turn my head again facing the correct direction, the cell will fire even though my body is facing that way. Uh-oh. Okay. I think the best way to describe what a head direction cell is doing is just to show you.
Are you going to talk about the history dependence when you rotate? Is there a animal speed?
I'll talk a little bit about that. So let me just show you what a head direction cell is doing. And where did he go? Did he leave?
He left. Okay. It's like a warranty. The car breaks after 1 year, one
day. We're supposed to go to the source button. Okay. Good luck. Okay.
And then. What is it? VHS?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Good deal. Okay. So I might just need to rewind this a bit. No, this is fine.
It's like wrestling.
This. Yes, that's what it is. We can talk about this later.
What a mess.
Yeah.
This is a space experiment?
Yeah. Here we go. Okay. Stop.
Hold
a second. Okay. All right. So. So here you'll see the rat, and whenever it fires, or pardon, whenever it faces 8 o'clock, you'll see the cell fire. It doesn't fire yet at all. There you go. So you watch it carefully. It won't divide. It doesn't matter what direction the body is facing, nor does it matter really whether the animal is moving or not. Right? No. There is an edge right there at 8 o'clock. That's true. If you look at this environment, it's a pretty homogeneous environment except for that large white piece of cardboard that you see there, which is acting as a landmark. Well, okay. There's a very sort of linear fall. Half past eight, okay. No. They will come. Well, listen to the firing rate of the cell, and if the animal's slightly off, let's say 8:30, you'll see that it'll fire, but it won't fire as fast. It doesn't matter. It's not like placers. No, there's very little adaptation in the cells. As it's coming in, it sort of fires slowly until it is exactly in the right direction. Okay. Source. That was easy. Okay, so this slide sort of summarizes a little bit of some of their properties, most of which I've already mentioned. It's the direction of the head, not the body position. It's the head direction in the horizontal plane. You really didn't see it that much in the video, but it's the head direction in this sort of azimuthal plane. It doesn't matter whether the animal pitches its head up or down a little bit, okay, or even rolls it slightly to the side. It's really just what the azimuthal head position is.
That's for this cell or in general?
In general for head direction cells.
So that's upside down, or it's upside down?
We'll get to that. Okay.
So there are no cells that you only code one of the three angles.
That's right. These cells only code
your pitch.
Well, you do code. No, you're not really coding pitch then. Well, no, you don't code pitch. There's another class of cells that codes pitch, sort of. Right? We can get to that too. What? This is pitch, sort of up and down. This is roll, and this is yaw.
These are yaw
cells. Yeah, yaw. YAW. So it's just encoding basically, direction in two-dimensional space. Now you could ask what happens when the rat sort of walks up a vertical wall or upside down, and we'll get to that at the end of the talk. So it fires when the animal is moving or still, and it pretty much fires independently of the location of the animal. It doesn't matter where the animal is located, and it doesn't really matter what behavior the animal happens to be emitting at the time. I mean, the video you saw, the animal was running around collecting food pellets that were sort of dropped in from up above randomly. So it was just the rat was just basically foraging, looking for where the food pellets were and eating them. Each cell only exhibits one preferred firing direction. So the direction that the cell likes to fire, we refer to that as the preferred firing direction. And those that might be familiar with place cells, occasionally place cells have two fields or two places that they like to fire. But you never find a head direction cell that has two directions. They always only have one. If you looked at the preferred firing directions over all the head direction cells that you record from in one animal, you would find that they're pretty much equally distributed randomly over 360 degrees. So pretty much all the directions are equally represented. It's not like it's encoding the direction that the cue card is in mostly.
This was affect you if you constrain the rats.
If you constrain.
So that it is always facing limited set of directions except for a testing firing.
Oh. Well, we've never done that in the sense of just limiting its sense of directions that it can be exposed to. I mean, because we always try to make sure we sample everything to see what the cell's doing. But if you got a cell that fired, let's say, that way, and you limited the rat to just looking at this way, I mean, I don't think the cell back here would ever fire, you know, no matter how long the animal was looking this way.
No, they're
actually in separate brain areas. We'll get to that too in a second. And I don't know if you could see this, but when the rat holds its head in the right direction, that cell continues to fire. Okay, so there's very little what physiologists call adaptation in the cell's firing rate. It doesn't, like once it goes into the right direction, you know, it starts firing and then sort of slows down. It's not the case. If it falls asleep, I don't know. I know if you anesthetize the rat, the cell will become quiet. But I've never really looked at it for the animal to fall asleep. The problem with falling asleep is you got to get lucky that the animal happens to fall asleep facing the right direction. You could. We haven't tried that. Yeah. No, if you put magnets around it, it won't have any effect.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It
fires the same way.
Exploratory or consummatory.
Yeah. Doesn't really matter whether it's consummatory or exploratory behavior. How sharp is it? It's pretty sharp. I'll show you some tuning curves now as we get into the. I mean, I have to admit there might be a slight decrease, but it's not. Yeah, I mean it's not like it goes. You know.
Catch up so that over a course of tens of seconds, so maybe it's irrelevant.
Well, over the course of tens of seconds, the other thing is, did the rat move its head slightly at all during that course of tens of seconds? We usually try to keep the rat moving around. So it samples different directions. But
you need to have like a little tremor in the head, keep the signal there, and if you freeze it, if you lose a tremor.
No, I've seen... that video probably wasn't a good demonstration, but we've seen plenty of times when the rat, certainly for 5 or 10 seconds, just holds its head there, and the cell will just continue to fire the whole time.
How does it fire periodically?
How does it fire what?
Yeah, is it like a random spike thing or
periodically? It's pretty. The inner spike interval is pretty. We've looked at a few of these. It's pretty regular. Yeah, the inner spike interval.
Some sense for fields which have an honor range, like radio station. Put it into a Faraday box.
Well, we recorded in a room that's a Faraday cage, so the room is completely shielded with copper wire, copper screening. Yeah. In fact, that's important to make sure that we keep the FM signals out. This gets back to your question a little bit, and this is just really a demonstration. It wasn't really representing the other cell, but the point is that if you were to draw vectors representing all the directions, the vectors are parallel. It's not like it points to a particular place on the wall. Okay. And this is a typical tuning curve of the cell where you're plotting the fire rate of the cell based on the rat's head direction from 0 to 360. And these are some of the parameters that we typically use. So we call this point right up here the preferred firing direction. And that point here, the maximal firing rate, is the peak firing rate. And then the range at which the cell fires above this background level here is referred to as the directional firing range of the cell. And most cells, a little bit of variability, but most cells have a range of about 90 degrees. So the amount, the range of head directions down here over which the cell's firing rate is above that of background levels is about 90 degrees. Now, some might be a little bit narrower, like 60, some might be a little bit wider, like 120. These are three typical cells that were all recorded from the same brain area, the postsubiculum, which I'll get to in a minute. And so these are all three real tuning curves. You can see that the major difference, they all have about the same sort of directional firing range. This cell is a little bit tuned a little bit wider. The biggest difference between all three is that their peak firing rate. So this cell has a peak firing rate of about 6. This one was a medium cell that had a peak firing rate almost 25. And this one was a very high firing rate cell that fired at 100 spikes per second. And I think although I and others have been working with these cells now for close to 10 years, I don't think anyone really has a handle on why some cells have low peak firing rates and some cells have high peak firing rates. It seems to be a particular characteristic of the cell, because no matter what manipulation you do, the cell retains that peak firing rate during the manipulation. During the dark, it would have the same peak firing rate, and I'll show you that coming up in a minute. Don't know. I mean, we think they're the same types of cells. Yeah.
But you're saying the strong issue is it truly goes to zero. Unlike the visual system where you get cells with different degrees of modulation.
Yeah.
You're saying, this truly is zero.
Yeah, you saw in the video that
right.
Well, this guy looked like it was maybe around one spike per second or something like that. I don't know if that's noise, like contamination from another cell, or whether that cell was perfectly isolated and it really did fire at one spike per second when the animal wasn't in the proper head direction.
And the other thing is that they're all very linear.
Yes, yes. So, in fact, I forgot to mention that. So each of these pictures here were averages over 8 minutes worth of data. Okay? So it's just not one instance of the animal passing its head through the thing. So this is an average over 8 minutes. And you can see that as you go away from the peak firing rate, there's a very linear fall off in the peak firing rate. And we've looked at this over individual episodes as the animal goes through. And you would see that, not every episode will let's say, have 100. Some episodes, like this direction here, some episodes might be 120. Some episodes could be 100. Some episodes could be 80. But they average out to be 100. If you looked at, a direction here on the side, you would see, some episodes might be 40. Some might be 50. Some might be 30. But they average out to about 40. So there is a very sort of general linear fall off as you move away from the preferred firing direction.
Low
one?
All of them have a very low firing rate for non-preferred direction. Is that generally the case?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's generally the case.
Did you say where you put it?
These are all in the postsubiculum. I'll show you where that is in a second. The presubiculum. It's part of the, I'll show you that.
Are they topographically?
Yeah, so that's another good question. No, they're not topographically organized. So if you have one electrode, as you go down through the brain area that we're recording from, it's not like you find one cell tuned to here, and the next one you encounter is tuned to here, the next one you encounter is tuned to here. It's not like the visual cortex. They seem to be random, as far as we could tell. I mean, it's not to say that there's no organization, but I haven't been able to uncover, you know, any sort of pattern or organization to them. I mean...
Not correlation.
What?
Not any correlation.
That's right. In fact, so yes, so occasionally we record two cells on one electrode wire. So obviously those two cells have to be very close together because they're being recorded from the same wire. And there's lots of instances where those cells are 90, you know, 120 degrees apart from one another.
You answered to Richard's question that these cells are fairly regularly. So not much variability in the spike intervals. Is that also true for such a low primary cell?
Yeah, I that's one direction that we have the data for that I want to look at a little bit more is this inner spike interval and in individual episodes. And I haven't really looked at it that closely yet. So I mean, that's a good question. But if I could give you one of the other areas where you find these cells is the anterior thalamus. And we have a paper that came out in 95 that has a very nice table in there that shows you how linear the fall off is of the firing rate from as you move away from the peak firing rate. You know, it shows you the number of episodes that you get different firing rates as you move away off the peak. I should mention that these points here they're being plotted every 6 degrees. So it's not every 1 degree, but it's every 6 degrees. But even over 90, so over 90 degrees here, let's say it's 90 degrees, you're going to get what? 90 divided by 6, 15 points that this curve is being composed of. Okay. So that's a little bit about some general properties. So now, the second topic was a little bit some sensory properties of these cells. And of course, you might want to know what controls the preferred firing direction of the cells. And the first thing you might want to do to look at that is to look at what we say, does the cue card exert stimulus control over the cell's firing? Now remember, there's that white piece of cardboard that was taped to the inside cylinder. So the experiment we do, of course, is we happen to rotate that cue card. And so here's an experiment where we start out with the cue card here located at the 3 o'clock position. Then we record there for 8 minutes. We take the animal out. Okay, we rotate the cue card over to the other side. We change the floor paper of the apparatus so that the animal doesn't have any olfactory cues left over within the apparatus. You bring the animal back in, put it back in the cylinder, record again for 8 minutes, and then after that you remove the animal again and then rotate the cue card back to its original position for a second standard session. And as you can see here by the black line and the red line, in both standard sessions, the cell fired here around 217 degrees or so. But then when you had rotated the cue card to 180 degrees, the cell's preferred firing direction was now shifted by 180 degrees. So the cell's preferred firing direction was staying locked to that cue card. Okay?
No, we were just talking. I mean, the slopes are matched beautifully. You might think you think of discrimination, and the peaks are kind of screwed. So maybe screw the edge.
Yeah, it's the peaks.
It's like an orientation. It's probably to suggest you are using the edge.
You're using the edge? You mean the edge of the card? You mean?
No, the edge of the curve.
Oh, I see.
You jitter, right? You do like modulation. You shift the position, the firing rate.
Sure. Yeah, that's. I mean, it's quite common that the tops of these peaks are sometimes a little bit scrambled. I mean, part of that might be due to some random error. I can describe it to you later, but if you did like a random walk, you know, of a point around here, you're going to get error above and error below. But if you do a random walk of error up there at the peak, you don't have the higher firing rate, so you might expect a little bit more variability right around the peak. But yeah, we can talk about more that later more. So you know that these cells, at least the preferred firing direction, uses the cue card. So you might ask, does removing that salient visual cue have any effect on the cell? And the answer to that is no. So here is an example where we are now recording two cells. I'm trying to remember if they were from the same wire or not. But in any case, the two cells are shown by the solid curves here in the standard session, the red, and the second cell is here, first cell is shown in blue, second cell is shown in red. And you can see the directions here and there, okay? Then after you record that, you take the animal out, take the cue card out, and you bring the animal back in. And I should say, when you bring the animal back in, you generally bring it in a box. And you disorient the animal by sort of turning the box around. So the animal's presumably disoriented, doesn't know what direction it happens to be facing. In theory, when you take it out of the box and you place it back down into the cylinder. Okay, and under those situations, now, what happens is the animal has really no way of judging what direction it happens to be facing, but the cells still remain firing in a very directional, specific manner. It's just that their angles, their preferred firing directions, have shifted a certain amount. Okay, now that amount that it shifts seems to be random. This is an example here where it shifted quite a bit, but there's lots of times where you might only see a shift of 40 or 50 degrees between the standard session and a no cue card session. And the interesting thing about this slide is that here you've got two cells recording simultaneously, and you can see that when one shifts this amount, the other one also shifted the same amount. So whatever one cell does, the other second cell does the same thing, as if the cells are locked together in a network. So whatever driving one cell is certainly driving the second cells the same amount. And that's true every time we've done this type of manipulation or other types of manipulations. Usually the whole thing operates as a network.
So this means that this cell's cone for direction relative to some frame changes every time you endorient this. So can you say relative to what?
What frame?
Does it depend on where the direction is the red?
Why couldn't it be random?
Something should be
yeah, I mean, I mean, in actual fact, I don't know whether it was random. But if you do the experiment perfectly without any cues, it should be random. I mean, if I spun you around, I mean, if this was a homogeneous room and I spun you around and put you down in here and then asked, you would probably would start orienting immediately. By just probably, as you say, the position you start out at, and as you walk around, you're tracking your initial, you're tracking yourself from your initial starting position.
One of the cells, for example, always has a preferred direction at the initial direction. Something like this.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. We haven't. We didn't test that. Well. I mean, like I said, I mean, this is an example where the thing shifted 180 degrees. You can get other times when they might only shift 30.
Right,
Stop the rat. Right. Yeah. I mean, we try to vary that. I mean, so we don't. Yeah. When we do these, so sometimes we put the rat in facing this way. Sometimes we put it in facing that way. And we also vary how we enter the rat. So I mean, it's a cylinder. You know, sometimes we bring the rat in from here. Sometimes we bring the rat in from this side. So the rat doesn't supposedly get used to any particular pattern.
The orientation was what just rotating it faster. You say
Probably, you know. And I'm walking around, too. You know, and I might go back like this. So the rat's also being translated as it's being rotated.
So you think this would presumably sort of destroy the
Well,
why would it destroy it?
We're actually exploring this a little bit now, is what happens to the cells firing when we're turning the box, okay? It, what happens is you hear an increase in background firing rate, and sometimes you'll hear a burst. The rat might be, though, using the box itself as a reference frame and just sort of, you know, memorizing its direction relative to the box, you know? So, but it, I mean, when you're spinning the animal around pretty quickly, you sometimes hear a burst of firing or an increase in the background firing rate. If you put the cue back, it goes back to the same spot. Yeah, I didn't show that there, but it does. Yeah. You, okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Now, a third thing we tried, and you'll see why this becomes important a little bit in a hopefully this before we have to break, but. Does the change in the shape of the environment have an effect on cell firing? Now, everything I've shown you so far has been cylinders. What happens when you put the animal in a square or a rectangle, you know, in the same room? And so that's what we did. And what you see here is five sessions where the first and the fifth and the third sessions were all sessions in the cylinder. And the second session was in a rectangle, and the fourth session was in a square. And in this particular case, you can see, and then you can see also too, how, notice how high these firing rates are here, upwards of 150. And the standard sessions all line up very nicely, and the square and the rectangle was a 90 degrees counterclockwise shift in the preferred firing direction. So, yes, there is a cue in the rectangle. It's the same side, that's right. So, you know, if we have a cylinder like that, we'll put the rectangle in like this and have a cue here. Yeah, and the square also the same thing. So if you put the animal in a different shaped environment, you generally get a shift in the cell's preferred firing direction. Okay? And that's picking the animal up and placing it in the other one. Okay.
Even though you're keeping the orientation of the paper.
That's right. Yep. And we'll come back to this, the significance of this.
But it's not systematic. It's not like it's always off by certain.
No. No.
This is one example. Other examples would give you all different.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So you get all different kinds of shifts with other. I mean, this one just happened to be, 90 degrees counterclockwise.
Yeah. If you actually did something instead of just using a piece of paper white paper, what if you had a white paper with a real feature on it, like a white paper with a black line down the middle, so it grew into the line, and then you put that in a rectangular or a square box, so it didn't have to glue to the edge of the white paper, so something like wall versus paper, but it had a definitive feature. Would you still get the shift?
So if you had
the paper is white,
but it have a little black line down the middle of it.
Right, so it's presumably a feature.
Okay, and then when you go here, you just do just the feature, no
paper. Put the little black feature. Yeah, right. So now it's the edge of the paper versus the wall. There's the edge of the paper versus the wall, but the edge of the paper is in the vertical.
Yeah. I think you would get the same thing. We haven't tried it. But I think you would get, I mean, just my experience with the cells is you would still get that same shift.
And just absolutely pedantic about this. I mean, if you took the original experiment and instead of going circle, box, do something gradual, like circle, oval.
Oh.
Which trying to understand. Yeah. See, the box introduces edges, right? It's pretty dramatic.
So that's right.
That's the only. Is that what you think?
Well, I'll tell you. Okay. You'll see why I'm even showing you this slide, because usually when I give a talk, I don't show this. But you'll see where I'm going with this in a few minutes. But I'll tell you, let me interject something else that we found interestingly in the last couple of years, where we've been doing a lot of experiments in a rectangle. It seems that where I told you in the cylinder, you got a nice even distribution of cells over 360, that when we started doing experiments in a rectangle, we had most cells lined up with one of the cardinal directions. So cells would be like this, you know, with like in this direction, I'd say that's north, plus or minus, you know, 15 degrees or so. Or they would be like this, plus or minus 15 degrees, or they'd be like this, plus or minus 15 degrees. We tended not to see cells that fired in between. So how the network was being mapped out with the cells, it seemed to be an over density of cells pointing to one of the four walls, as opposed to pointing at a 45 degree angle in between the direction of the four walls.
So it's two things. It's tending to be towards a wall, tending to be towards the walls, and one of the four, and it's also one of the four walls, so it's broken symmetry.
Yeah.
Is the ship the same in different cells for a given environment?
Yes, if you were recording, so this is only one cell, but if you were recording another second cell simultaneously, you would see that the second cell would also shift 90 degrees counterclockwise. Again, all the cells are acting as a network.
So there's one train of light before this train, right?
Yeah,
there's
a different
information.
Yeah, but
it's not
a
Oh, if it's a distribution of the...
Well, you're saying the circular environment,
yeah,
it would be uniform.
That's right.
Rectangular, you have clusters.
Yeah.
And now it's each of the light, it would still keep the distribution of the configuration. You know, for example, if it's in the rectangular, it's each of the light. So
I see. Yeah. What do I think would happen? I mean, we haven't done it, but what would I think would happen? I was sort of surprised that we got this distribution, I mean, in the rectangle. I mean, I guess if you turn off the light, well,
But definitely because turning off the light.
Yeah.
The distribution is incompatible with the second distribution if you say that they move at the net.
How's there a contradiction? So, I mean, if you have one cell that's, let's say, tuned at 0 degrees, and another cell that's tuned at 90, and
you have, say, 8 cells, each of the 8 wings in the circle.
Okay.
And then
right.
You place it in the rectangle.
Yeah.
And if it behaves as a network, they're all.
That's I see what you're saying. That's right. So something's got to move more than another. Well. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
That's why it's interesting. You may say here, okay, the visual cues just take over, they deform you there. But it's interesting if you're in the dark, whether you somehow return to a uniform distribution or.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, if you.
Yeah. But if you really have a network which naturally wants to have uniform distribution of the visual views can take over the formally, but you take them out, it goes back to the natural configuration. Or any of these is natural.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, we've only done this the last couple of years in relationship to something else, so we haven't really explored it too much. I mean, but we just noticed that the cells tended to be aligned with one of the four directions in the rectangle. But I mean, you're right that it seems that you would have a conflict there, that some cells are going to have to rotate more than other cells when you go from a cylinder to a rectangle. I'll think about that one a little more. Yes, well, yeah, I'm going to get to that too, the ring model a little bit. But you're right, it's hard to account for that in a ring model, in a continuous attractor model, if that indeed is what's happening. I mean, you would think that everything would be pretty hardwired so that you could... Just to deform it? Yeah. Okay. So next topic is a little bit, how does the signal get generated? Where in the brain do you find these cells? This actually isn't very clear, but this is a cross-section through the hippocampus right here with the anorhinal cortex down here. And for those who aren't familiar with hippocampal anatomy, usually when you talk about the hippocampus, you talk about three areas. This area right there, it's called the dentate. This area here, the CA3. And then this area coming down here is CA1. And all these areas, CA1, CA3, and the dentate, all have place cells within them. There are no head direction cells. Now, right next to the hippocampus, from about the CA1 here, this area right here, is usually called the subicular complex. And it's usually composed of three areas. One is this S, which is the subiculum. And then where these superficial cells layers come in, this area right here is called the presubiculum. And then this area over here is called the parasubiculum. And then down below here, you get into the anorhinal cortex, this EC, which is the major input into the dentate within the hippocampus. Now, this presubiculum area right here, there's, at least in rats, the dorsal portion and a ventral portion. So there's a portion of the presubiculum that sits up a little bit more superior in the brain, and there's a ventral portion that sits a little bit more inferior within the brain. And anatomists, for reasons I won't get into here, have referred to as this dorsal portion of the presubiculum. They've called it the postsubiculum, just to confuse you. Okay, and I mention all that is because Jim Ronk, in the mid-1980s, was trying to stick an electrode here in the subiculum, which was right next to CA1, because he was interested in what would happen to the place cell signal as it's leaving CA1 and going over to the subiculum. The CA1 projects to the subiculum. He was interested in seeing, well, what happened to the place signal as it went over to the subiculum. And one of his electrodes apparently, and very serendipitously, missed and wound up in this presubicular area, in the dorsal part of it, the postsubiculum. And that was where he first identified and discovered the head direction cells. Okay. What? Jim Ronk. R-A-N-C-K. He's at SUNY Brooklyn. What does subiculum do? I mean, functionally?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone really has identified a particular role for it. There are place cells. No. I mean, certainly no agreed upon role. You know. I mean, different people have used it for different things in various models.
Ronk and O'Keefe,
Ronk.
Ronk and O'Keefe.
Yeah. Well, O'Keefe was the one who really discovered place cells about 1970-71. And Jim Ronk was the one who discovered the head direction cells about 1984. And I did my postdoc with Jim Ronk in 86. So that's how I got introduced to it. So I cannot claim, I was not the discoverer of these cells. Now, here's a little wiring diagram of different brain areas. And here's the circuit that I was just outlining. The entorhinal cortex projects to the hippocampus. The hippocampus projects to the subiculum. And the subiculum projects to this dorsal presubicular area, which I told you is called the postsubiculum. And the yellow here shows you where the place cells are found, and this is where the head direction cells were found. There are pretty much no place cells within the postsubiculum.
But there's some relevant place.
No, we're going there, yeah.
And so what fraction of the postsubiculum
cells? 20-25%. Yeah, so 20-25% of the cells within the postsubiculum will have this head direction correlate. You find some theta cells, and you find a lot of cells that have a very sort of high firing rate, like cortical cells, but you can't correlate them with anything.
But, so you either it's a head direction cell or not. You don't have like lousy head direction.
Right. Yeah.
Very sharp distinction.
Yeah.
Again, you may have two cells nearby, one is head direction.
Yep. So, let me back up. So, because the head direction cells were found here, we've been sort of trying to understand the circuitry a lot and started recording from some other places, as well as lesioning some of these other areas to see what effect it has on these head direction cells. And here, are two other brain areas where we've recorded head direction cells. So here's a cell here in the postsubiculum. It was a low firing rate cell. Here's a medium firing rate cell in the anterior dorsal thalamus. And here's a very high firing rate cell in the lateral mammillary body. I mean, they're all, the lateral mammillary body, which is true, they do tend to have a little bit wider directional firing ranges than the cells in these areas. But still, they maintain this sort of triangular or Gaussian sort of shape to them. Yeah. So those cells were found here and here. Okay. Now.
Anterior dorsal thalamus gets input from.
Gets input. It gets some input from the postsubiculum. So there's reciprocal connections going back and forth. It gets a very prominent input from the mammillary nuclei coming up like this. And then it also receives some top-down input from the cortex, posterior cingulate, which in the rat is usually called retrosplenial cortex.
So this is like an interlaminar part of thalamus that doesn't receive direct sensory input from
the mammary? It's not intralaminar. The anterior thalamic nuclei. It's a group that sits anterior and a little bit on the medial.
But no, directly
from
the posterior organ? No.
That's right. It's not like ventral posterior, medial geniculate, or lateral geniculate. It's not like that. And it's long been associated with the limbic system, so it has very prominent connections with the hippocampus and portions of the circuit. Now let me just, so here is that same diagram sort of filled in, and over 10 years, so we've recorded in these two areas. Bruce McNaughton's lab has, and now Pat Sharp's lab have indicated that there are head direction cells up here. And Sherry Mizumori's lab about 7 or 8 years ago actually identified some cells that were in the lateral dorsal thalamus here that were also head directional. So you can see here are all the head direction cells. No place cells in any of these areas. Here are the place cells. No head direction cells in those areas. The two information seems to stay segregated. We haven't been able to see any in here. I don't think Bruce or Sherry said there was any topography to those areas as well. These cells, I should say, are a little bit more controversial. I've looked in here myself for these cells, and I haven't been able to find them. But and this area sits right next to the anterior dorsal thalamus, so it's easy to confuse them. There's only one paper by Sherry Mizumori that's seen them here.
It should be light green.
Well.
So
So you are drawing arrows. I would like to know more about the nature of
arrows. Those are.
If you manage to turn around your face field, your direction cells by say 90 degrees, will all the face fields also rotate?
Yes. Jim Kinnearum.
Is it completely correlated, or can you somehow one side turn and the other leave?
No, I think the one or two studies that have been done with that, where they recorded the place cell and a head direction cell simultaneously, was done by Jim Kinnearum working with Bruce McNaughton. And they showed very nicely that usually what the place cells did, the head direction cells did too, or vice versa. So if one rotated 90 degrees, the whole thing shifted 90 degrees. So you never got a dissociation between the two, except for if something remapped. So if the place cells remap, then sort of all bets are off a little bit, because, I mean, then the place cell may not fire at all. But in general, if you got an angular shift in the place cells, you also got the same angular shift with the head direction cells.
The recent study by Jim, where he has the proximal cube rotate.
Yeah, one way.
And the distal rotate in the other direction.
That would be interesting to see what the head direction is. I don't know. 5 minutes, good. Was I raising your hand, or you're telling me 5 minutes?
But where is the outside world coming in?
Probably up here in the posterior parietal.
That's the
visual information. We had a poster just last week that showed, this is jumping ahead here, we always thought that visual information came down from here into the circuit. But if you make a lesion here, you can still get nice cue control in all these areas down here.
And where's the vestibular system coming in?
Coming in here. That's the direction I'm going. We're going to have to get to that afterwards, but... given that the head direction cells have been identified in all these brain areas, which areas are critical for generating the signal? And I'm going to sum up a lot of experiments that we and others have done by just, first of all, stating that if you're recording here and you lesion either this one, the posterior cingulate cortex, or you lesion the hippocampus, or you lesion the postsubiculum, or you lesion the lateral dorsal thalamus, the head direction cells here are just fine. They don't go away. I mean, actually, they're fine in the sense that the signal is still present. There are some funny things that happens. Like sometimes they may not rotate very well with the cue card, but you still get directional specific firing when you're recording here. Okay? Now again, this is lesioning one of these areas, not all of them simultaneously. Now in contrast, and I should mention, if you lesion this area and record here, you lose the directional signal here. So recording head direction cells here, you lesion this, you will lose the directional cell signal there. Right? So the anterior thalamus seems to be certainly very important. Now, Pat Sharp and Tad Blair about a year ago in our lab, Matt Tolman working with us, has shown if you lesion this area here, you'll get rid of the directional signal there. So the lateral mammillary nuclei seems to be very important for generating the signal here. Now, so far, we've only lesioned this and recorded here. We haven't recorded in all these other areas. But we would predict that based on our results that if you lesion this, you lose the signal in these other areas, that lesioning this will cause loss of the head direction cell signal throughout all the remaining parts of the circuit.
But does this affect? It's kind of cross.
No, you still get a place cell signal, and I wasn't going to go over that. We have actually a paper we're about to submit where you lesion either the postsubiculum or the anterior dorsal thalamus, and you record places up here, and you still get them. They're a little bit different, but you still get them. You still see. They're a little bit less stable, but that's sort of another story. So let me just try to get through this last little bit here and let's get to a good breaking point. So as I said, lesions of the lateral mammillary nuclei led to the absence of finding head direction cells in the anterior dorsal thalamus. And so therefore the lateral mammillary nuclei and the neural information projecting to it are critical for the generation of the head direction cells activity. So is intimating or leading where you were going, what brain areas and what type of information is projected to the lateral mammillary nuclei? And I was going to say, this is where we're going to stop because we'll talk about the importance of the vestibular system next. Okay.
Yes.
Right here.
So what is the lateral mammillary?
What is it? Yeah. If you actually.
It's very nice.
Oh, okay, good. Is it? I hope it's the right level.
I hope you don't mind.
Okay. No, not at all. Here, you might be able to see. No, actually, you won't, because that's a dorsal view. No, the mammal. I was looking for a ventral view.
It's like a small number of cells. Is the anatomy?
I think if you just Boris has slides. I mean,
transparency.
So
we're gonna
close
the
okay. Computer. Okay. Yeah. Well, let me put it to sleep. Actually, yeah. I'm actually nervous about even quit. Yeah. Let's just do. Oh, that's interesting. Let's just put it to sleep. Actually, you know what? I might.
Show again.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do for the next hour, so I might do something on it.
Yeah.
The mammillary nuclei are. There are two little sort of bulbous structures that are bright white, which is why they're called mammillary nuclei, that sit at the base of sort of on the ventral sort of base of the brain on the ventral surface. They're part of what's sort of the hypothalamic system. I mean, people often they're right by the hypothalamus.
And people know the anatomy of it. What's the connectivity?
They don't know. I mean, yeah. I was just actually talking to Ketchin Zhang about this. I don't think there's any really good studies about the internal architecture of it.
Yeah, that's what
I could tell you what projects into it, which I'll tell you next. It's the dorsal tegmental nucleus, and it's a very strong inhibitory circuit that projects into it.